This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello, I'm Sarah McNeil. I'm from Canberra at the moment, recently from Adelaide. I'm a former diplomat but have spent much of the last 20 years working for the Anglican Church and was most recently the Dean of St Peter's Cathedral here in Adelaide. One of the great joys of my time here in Adelaide was being a member of the advisory committee for this festival, wanting to stimulate this conversation in this wonderful city about ideas, some of them dangerous, some of them provocative, all of them getting us to think deeply about where we live and how we live. So it is a great joy for me to welcome you today to this one of the final sessions of this Adelaide Festival of Ideas in this beautiful environment that we have here in the Town Hall. And our session today is a reflection on Australia and the post-secular society. As we begin, I would like to acknowledge that today we are gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationship with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we respect their elders, past and present. Before I introduce our panellists today, a little bit of housekeeping. Please switch your mobile phone to silent during the presentation. And you are most welcome to tweet at IdeasAdelaide, all one word, with the hashtag #AFOI. In this session, we'll explore questions such as, is God back or has God ever left? But if so, who's God? Is the rising tide of secularism that was confidently proclaimed in the dying decades of the last millennium retreating in the face of resurgent religion or resurgent spirituality? What are the effects of globalization on our public discourse and our collective consciousness? Does a shifting geostrategic balance signal new understandings? And our panelists for this conversation today are Philip Adams, whom I sure needs no introduction, but I shall introduce him nonetheless. Philip is one of Australia's 100 living national treasures. He has 4 honorary doctorates, and he has interviewed thousands of the world's most influential politicians, historians, archaeologists, novelists, theologians, economists, philosophers, and conversationalists. He's a driving force of Australian film, radio, television, and the arts. The National Australia Day Council, the Commission for the Future, the Centre for the Mind, the Families in Distress Foundation, and of course of various boards, including particularly from our point of view, the Festival of Ideas here in Adelaide and also in Brisbane. Speaking with him will be Paul Collins, also a very well-known figure. Paul is the author of 13 books on belief, on ecology and on history. He's a writer, a broadcaster, a commentator, and he served as a Catholic priest for 33 years in many kinds of situations, both urban and rural. He's a former specialist editor of religion for the ABC. He also lives in Canberra, and his most recent book, Judgment Day, confronts the moral and spiritual issues embedded in the interface between religion and ecology. I'm also delighted to introduce for you Professor Salman Saeed, Director of the International Centre for Muslim and Non-Muslim Understanding at the University of South Australia. He has previously worked at the universities of Manchester, Salford and Leeds, and his numerous publications explore culture and politics, the effects of the post-colonial condition on so-called mainstream socio-political processes and structures. He has a rare achievement. His book, A Fundamental Fear, Eurocentrism and the Emergence of Islamism, was nominated for the British Sociological Association's Philip Abrams Prize, but has been banned by the Malaysian government. He recently co-edited a volume called Thinking Through Islamophobia, Global Perspectives. And our fourth panellist this afternoon is Justice John Sulan. John was born in Prague and graduated from Adelaide University, was then appointed as a Queen's Counsel for South Australia and a judge of the District Court and then of the Supreme Court here in South Australia. His community involvement includes being chair of the National Judicial College of Australian Indigenous Issues, the committee member and chair of the Law Society of South Australia's Indigenous Law Students Mentoring Program, immediate past chair of Jewish Community Services, Inc. He is also immediate past chairman of Project Abraham, a project devoted to promoting better understanding and tolerance of Islam, Judaism and Christianity. He's an advisory member of the Abraham Institute and chair of the B'nai B'rith Anti-Defamation Oration Committee. We have indeed an eclectic and very well qualified panel for our discussion today. And the discussion will be structured in the following way. I'm going to ask each panelist a question, inviting him to give a 2 to 3 minute response. We'll then have an open discussion for about 20 minutes, after which I will invite questions from you, the audience, for another 15 to 20 minutes. And you'll see that there is a microphone here in the centre aisle, and I understand there's one at the back too, which is a bit hard to see from here. I'd ask you to ask your questions from the microphones so that they can be easily heard. In the last 5 to 10 minutes, I'll invite each panellist to give a 1 to 2 minute wrap-up and final comment. And I promise I will be merciless in my timekeeping. My first quick question is for John Sulan. John, you are one of South Australia's eminent lawyers, and you also have a passionate commitment to multiculturalism and to civil society, as your CV showed us so clearly. Do you think that Australia has entered a new phase of understanding the relationship between law and religious interests? Has the world changed over the last decade or two? And if so, what does that mean for us and for our legal system?
Well, certainly the answer to the question is that has the world changed in the last decade has to be yes. It's changed dramatically in many ways, and I could spend some time talking about that. The influence that that has on the law, and in particular the law in Australia, is that our legal thinkers and our judges others have to become and are attempting to become acutely aware and understanding other cultures and other religions. I was brought up in the legal tradition that the reasonable man was the person on the London omnibus. Nowadays one wouldn't talk about the reasonable man, one would talk about the reasonable person, and the reasonable person is certainly not on the London omnibus. And judicial thinking has had to develop itself around the changing society that we live in. A very good example of that is that we are much more now aware, as judges and lawyers, of the cultural problems of our Aboriginal community. We have to be aware of it. 40 years ago, when I commenced practicing law, the thought that a judge might spend time trying to understand Aboriginal culture was almost unknown. A month ago, I spent a week with a number of other judges on the APY lands developing and attempting to develop an understanding of their culture. And the same with religion. We're seeing it in England at the moment. The debate as to whether some of Sharia law should be recognised by the English courts, where there are large groups now who no longer believe in monogamy but polygamy, and whether English law should recognise polygamous marriages. So they're just some examples of the way in which the law and the way in which society is developing have to marry one another, and we have to develop that understanding.
Thank you. I hope
that answers part of the question.
Thank you. Salman Saeed, in a recent speech, you noted that you don't know any true secularists And you went on to say that it's not straightforward to opt out of religion, and people are secular within a religious tradition. Does this mean that you think that the idea of a secular society is misconceived, or perhaps a Western misunderstanding?
I think when I said that there weren't any true secularists, what I meant is that most of the time when I meet people who call themselves secularists, they're basically talking about Christian theology without God or Christ in it. But it's the same kind of problems. Some of the problems, the reasons they give for not believing in God are basically a radicalization of problems within Christian theology, like why does a good God allow bad things to happen? Well, if you don't believe God is good or bad, you don't have to have the question of why these things happen. Now, in relation to what I was trying to guess at is that most people who are secularists are probably post-Christian in the sense that Christianity is deeply, deeply ingrained. Most of the people's names in this audience come from them through Christian sources, whether they like it or not. However, they may be inflected through Celtic or Anglo-Saxon or whatever other Latin languages. So in a sense, it's not that easy to step outside religion because our sense of what is good, what is moral, is so deeply ingrained in a particular religious tradition, even if we've forgotten much of that religious tradition. People may still think that Christmas is about shopping rather than, you know, Christ's birthday, but it still marks out the calendar. I mean, so I think one has to be a bit more nuanced about saying how easy it is to step outside religion and become secular, in a sense that secularity is a problem that arises within particular religious tradition rather than something universal. And I think that's something that perhaps needs to be borne in mind. Quite often people act, well, belief in God is like a fairy tale, and when you grow up, you don't believe in fairy tales. And the trouble is there's a bit more than that. It's not just about a fairy tale. And after all, you know, people may believe that Santa Claus doesn't exist, but they don't stop toy manufacturers making sure that across Christmas time, parents are bombarded with lists for Cat Santa. Yeah. So I think we have to be just a bit more humble about turning very kind of commonsensical notions about existence and non-existence of God into a larger debate about secularism.
And Paul, do you think that God is back in public discourse, if God ever lived? And if so, who's God? We come out of, as someone has said, a very Christian tradition here in the West. Wherever we are now, we come out of a very Christian tradition. Is God back in public discourse? Is Christianity in Australia becoming more culturally sidelined than it was, than it has been, or perhaps less?
I've always wanted to go first in these talks because then you get the point that you want to make in first before Salman steals it from you. But I was going to start with Manning Clark. I was going to show off and say, dear old Manning Clark believed, and he was a great friend of Philip's as well as a friend of mine, and he believed that Australian culture was... The foundation of Australian culture lies in three sources. It lies in evangelical Protestantism, it lies in Irish Catholicism, and it lies within the principles of the Enlightenment. He did forget that there were actually Jews in the First Fleet. There were convict Jews, of course, there wouldn't have been. look at what you've come from, you know, from convict to Supreme Court judge. So, the Irish, look at us.
one might argue there's not a lot of difference.
No, probably not. No. Now, so, in other words, I completely agree with Salman that the reality is that the culture in which we live is formed by it. By Christianity. It may be a post-Christian society. You might want to say that. I also agree that without any doubt, secularism is really a post-Christian phenomenon. It is not not a post-religious phenomenon. So I think that the first thing that we've got to own is that we are living on the consequences of the Judeo-Christian ethic. We are living on the consequences of Christian history. We are living on the consequences of the Protestant interpretation of Christianity and the Catholic interpretation of Christianity. Those are the formative roots of our culture, and all of that, I think the most blessed thing about all of that is that the other force at work is the Enlightenment, which, of course, in some ways is the origin of our secularism. And I stand as a Catholic who happily belongs within a secular society. But I'm not sure that I live in a post-Christian society, and I think that that is the distinction that needs to be made. That's the first point I want to make. The second point I knew I'd get in and no one else would say it, and I hope I'm not stealing it from Philip, but I don't think I am. And that is that what was the place like that these people arrived in? They arrived in the totally other, the totally other place, the non-Europe, the remnants of Gondwana land. They met not the most primitive people on earth, but the most different people on earth. No one could be more different than Aborigines and Captain Phillips boys and girls. So, in fact, the Aborigines seemingly were gobsmacked by the behaviour of the British, gobsmacked above all by the cruelty, by the flogging. So it's the place we live in is different. I think we're still discovering it. I think we're still discovering that we live in one of the most profoundly spiritual places on earth because nature here is still relatively intact. It has not been destroyed as it has been totally, virtually totally destroyed in Europe, making the entire European landscape industrial, because that's in a way what agriculture is. We live in a place where nature still has some potency. And because we live here, we are forced to be spiritual. I hate the word. I'd rather say we are forced to relate to the transcendent. So I don't think God's gone. I think God's been here all the time. It all depends on what you mean by God.
Philip Adams, where do you think Australian society is headed? Has the tide of secularisation been checked? Was there a tide of secularisation? Or is too much being made of a relatively small shift in the religious demographics of the country? Are secularists another group competing for a share of the faith market, along with Christians, Muslims, Jews and Buddhists?
I'll answer that in the way I always do, rather discursively. I'm 72.
You have?
I'm 72 years old. I became an atheist at 5, which means I've been an atheist for
67
years. I was an atheist for at least 5 years before I ever heard the word, and before I had the faintest notion that there was someone else around who could share my disbeliefs. I was born into a Christian manse, a congregational manse, which had no effect on my thought process as a child, zero, because my father left for the war shortly thereafter. And I suddenly realised that God was a redundant notion. I just couldn't see the reason for believing in him for a second. This led me to join the Communist Party, groping around for a belief system, when I was 15. And at that stage, I would have thought that by 10 to 4 on a Sunday in 2001, the churches would all be empty, the synagogues would be museums, the Vatican would be a theme park, although perhaps...
One could argue.
Perhaps that's exactly what the Vatican is.
Yes.
And we would be living in a post-religious society. As I've got older, I've mellowed. I'm no longer, in fact haven't been for 30 years, a Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins sort of atheist. I've always understood the religious, the yearnings, the fears, the curiosity that creates religion. And I acknowledge that it's been social glue for millennia. But I find the argument now, so I sympathise with people who have religious belief. I don't attack them. I might agree line for line with what a Hitchens or a Dawkins says, but I hate the tone of voice. I think it's vicious, lethal, cruel and stupid, basically. But then I've never liked Richard Dawkins. Now, where I think the whole thing becomes meaningless, because we're clearly not living in a post-secular society. We never got to a secular society. The world is divided between great clashes of religious civilizations. The real threat to religion in this world is not the puny voice of the atheist. It is the internal struggles within religions and between them. We don't matter. We're marginal. But what makes me angry is when I hear a word like spiritual copyrighted by people of religious persuasion. I'm here to tell you that atheists can be every bit as spiritual as the, you know, someone who is besotted with faith. In fact, I would make the observation that about 90%, in my experience, of people who profess a religion have no real interest in it whatsoever, and they treat Christmas as if it were a shopping thing. They might front to a wedding or a funeral, but basically religion is pretty much irrelevant to them. Whereas people like me, and there's been quite a few of them at the Ideas Festival, have a great belief or a great sense of the numinous. Now, that's my preferred word for spiritual. And that's the feeling you get when you walk outside on a dark, cloudless night and you look up there and you look up at billions and billions and billions of suns, knowing, in Carl Sagan's memorable phrase, there are more suns up there than grains of sand on earth. That sense of awe, of reverence, of fear, because it certainly involves a dread of personal mortality, is as profound a form of spirituality, I submit, as anything experienced by someone of religious persuasion. And yet I do not believe in any of the gods on offer. I've got a house full of gods. I collect antiquities. I've got hundreds of them, piled up all over the place. No one believes in any of them anymore.
We've got a few popes.
Well, you're going to come. See, he and I are, in fact, members of a secret organisation. I'm not supposed to say that.
No.
Not a secret anymore.
Yes, a one secret organisation.
So, basically, I think it's a non-issue. On political issues, I find again and again the most left-wing people in the country are Josephite nuns or Jesuits. Mm. And I often find myself, making common cause with them on progressive issues. This is something that Dawkins and Hitchens can't see. So if people of goodwill are the ones that interest me, it's people who want to do good and, change society by small increments for the better, or at least stop getting worse. And I don't judge it on religion, I really don't. And I don't think it's post-pre, whatever, secular. I think all of that is fatuous.
So we are in a religiously and culturally diverse society here in Australia today. I think that can be taken as a given. And I would be very interested to hear your views about our civic responsibilities towards each other in that kind of context. Salman Syed, you might like to start that conversation.
Well, it seems to me that our responsibilities don't really change whether one professes to be a society which is recognised as being culturally or religiously diverse and then not. I think there's a lot of alarm about diversity or people making contradictory claims. Things that you don't need to belong to different religions or different cultures or whatever that may mean to actually make conflicting claims. That's why we have courts. All civic life is about, often, it's not all, but sometimes it's about jostling together, doesn't mean that you necessarily have to agree on everything or you get along with everything, but you jostle around. And if the jostling gets too fierce or someone thinks it's been hard done by, you go to the law. I mean, that's basically how it works. I think what happens is this, that there's a quest among the equivalent of the chattering class to try and make everything fit together and to have an overall narrative about how and what these things. And I think if you think about it, I'm not sure, A, is that necessary to have an overall narrative. I mean, it seems to me general what we need is perhaps a more facilitated, more empowered sense of etiquette, which is not necessarily requires us to make sure that all these kinds of different divergent claims come together, because quite often when people have conflicts, there can be about anything, but it doesn't, and they can be resolved on a case-by-case thing. You don't have to make grander claims. I think by trying to make grander claims and link these conflicts, you actually make them more difficult to resolve. rather than easier to resolve. And it seems to me that in any society, what you want to do is you want their people to get along enough so they can jostle along with each other. But at the same time, you don't want to make it a consensus, because in a sense, creativity comes from contact with difference, with contact with strangeness, and with contact with disagreement. If all of us agreed fundamentally on everything, this would be one of the most boring panels that we would spend your time on. All we'd have to say, none of us would need to speak. We could just say, we agree. What is interesting is that we may disagree, but at least we've worked out how to disagree. When I'm speaking, unless something very oppressing, other people keep quiet, etc. But that's just a rule, a commonsensical rule. We don't really need more than that. If we did need more than that, you will intervene. But other than that, you need to have a degree of diversity. And I think for any kind of society, we shouldn't be frightened about people having differences. The thing is simply to accept that those differences
we
are all
shouldn't
be.
No, we are.
Well,
We're sitting in a country which proclaims tolerance as its great collective virtue, and it does. If you ask 90% of Australians, what is it in the Australian character that is worth celebrating? We're tolerant. We had a white Australia policy in place for 70 years. Apartheid, I think, lasted little more than 15 years. It was an appalling notion. It has surged back since the Hansen phenomenon, or has been admitted to. And we now take the view that if you come to Australia in a boat, that's fine. But if you come in a boat, you're almost by definition, you're Muslim. In fact, most of the boat people have been Christian. And you're dangerous. And so the white Australia policy, manipulated shamefully in this community by a succession of politicians over the last 15 years, is alive and kicking. We are not tolerant. We only profess it.
Well,
can I say, I think we do have an overarching narrative, actually. I think that it is true that I agree, every time I go near a Muslim, I end up agreeing. We agree on this, which I think is very, very interesting, because when we look at history, we should be disagreeing, because, we fought for a long time. But the reality is that I think religious people come with their difference, and I absolutely agree that it's our difference that makes us interesting.
And dangerous.
And dangerous, yes, when the differences are driven to the fundamentalist extent, to the extent of a real fundamentalism. But just let me say, I do think there is an overarching narrative. I went this morning to the lecture on The Cosmos Will Get Us in the End, which was a brilliant lecture. But I think science is providing us with a story of origins, an overall story of origins, a big picture that we can all accept. And then all of our, if you like, particular revelations fit. We deal with them within that overarching context. And I also think that while I understand what Philip is saying, I do think Australia has developed a civil discourse whereby we can talk to each other. I mean, Australian history was full of bigotry. I mean, it was a mortal sin for me to go into Sarah's church when I was a child. You'll be pleased to know I committed the mortal sin regularly and never confessed it to Father, you see. Nowadays, that's an unreality. I'd never met a Jewish person in my childhood. I'd never met an Aboriginal person. I'd never met a Muslim person. But we now live in a society where civil discourse... See, I think that's the other thing that we've got to hang on to, that we've got to be able to have our differences and express our differences, and at times express them firmly, but at the same time respect the position of other people, and not only live with that, but actually respect it.
Well, I think I agree with Simon. Very often Muslims and Jews do agree, actually.
You've had to deal with Christians all these years.
But I think the key to understanding one another and to living together is to educate ourselves and to make sure the community is educated, so that we understand what the various religions and the cultures stand for. We understand the basic precepts in each of them, and I think that the keys to educating our young, our students, Muslims are not some strange group of people over there, and Jews are not some strange group of people over there. We have to bring education and teach about our religions.
But what
and our
we're
conscience.
Doing instead, we've had a succession of political leaders
yes.
that quite deliberately press the dog whistle.
Yeah, that's right.
That have been creating and intensifying bigotry. I think you're right. Left to yourselves, people yeah. finally work out a deal. Yeah. When I was a kid at the local state school, it was just after the war, and the refugee children were coming in, and we'd say, go back to your own country, you refo.
I was
refo.
One of those. Yes.
You know the feeling. Yes. It was yeah. appalling. Yeah.
We had to be more Australian than the Australians.
Well, we were echoing what our parents said, yeah. the bigotry in our parents. But 10 years later, you know, I was riding around Melbourne on a Vespa, going to coffee shops saying, grazie and prego, you know. And we were all rejoicing in the same phenomenon. Yeah. But let it be said that some of the waves of intolerance in this country come from the previous wave of migrants. It's not just the central, whatever that is, the core, the hub society that gets into this business of almost deliberate, willful ignorance about the others.
Well, I'm astounded that some of the people who were immigrants in the 50s are now very much anti-immigration, anti-the boat people, wanting to send them all back. And I can't understand. It's very difficult for me to understand how people who were immigrants were driven away from their countries, came here as immigrants, some of them legally, perhaps some of them illegally, have now developed in a way in which they're not accepting a new wave of immigration because they're different. It's very difficult.
Aren't we lucky to live in a country of such incredible complexity? Shut up in a minute. Such incredible complexity.
First Philip, then
it's
Simon,
like
then
a
questions.
Bucket of gravel. We don't live in a society that's made of left, right, black, white, Muslim. You know, it's not simple division. We're a bucket full of cultures, and you shake them around, but they won't break. You can't break a bucket full of stones, but with the passing of time, the stones rub together and they start to get a bit of polish. I love diversity. I just love it. I can't see what the problem is.
Salman. Yes.
I agree.
Invite Salman to say something, then we'll come to you for questions.
No, I think the only thing I wanted to add was really, I think one part that we've left out of this conversation is that it's not just that Australia is very different, but the world is very different. And Australia's place in the world is very different. Now, I'm very reluctant to say anything about Australia since I've arrived here very recently, but I think there's a general sense in which the world in which what could be called the West was dominant is somehow at least passing away. And you see that in various ways, through the economic growth of China, through all these kinds of things, but also within that, a certain kind of sense of white privilege, which was institutionalized in the world, is also passing away. So this basically creates a tension which is happening throughout the West, including Australia, between two different kinds of constituencies. There are people in Europe, in North America, in Australia, who are kind of trying to hold on to like a 1950s version of the world in which white privilege, whiteness, etc., was completely institutionalized. And they're those who are actually looking toward the future. The future is actually, in a sense, scary because it means a loss of privilege, but it means a different way of living. And I think that tension between a kind of a new Australia and a kind of old Australia is being played out with great intensity here because of that. I mean, you know, one of the things that we always find as something coming new is that you realize 40% of Australians are now from, you know, non-Anglo-Celtic backgrounds, at least. Now, that's a big shift. And it means the kind of, but are this non-Anglo-Celtic background, are they represented in the national story of Australia? When people abroad see Australia, they don't necessarily see that. And one of the things I think Australia has difficulty in is being representing itself to globally as a place which is different, which has become different in the last 20, 30 years, and which is cognizant of the changes of the world. And I think there is a narrative in that sense missing to how to think of themselves as a kind of a world island people rather than just a people from the offshore, you know, Surrey, and landed here in the 1950s, and that's basically the entire story. So I think there is a challenge there to be part of the world rather than sort of part of Gondwana land or relics of that, and I think that's important.
Thank you. I'd like now to invite members of the audience to come to one of the two microphones here. I would ask you to keep your questions short and to the point so that we can get through as many of questions as possible in the 10 to 15 minutes that we have. Yes, here at the front mic.
Quick defence of Richard Dawkins. I was at the Atheist Conference last year as a Quakist, a Quaker atheist. At his question and answer, and a young woman got up and she said, "Richard, I will be on my knees tonight if no one else will be. But I'd like to ask you a question about creationism." Well, the audience started to boo and hiss and call her down. And Richard, to his credit, and quite surprised, because that was my view, that he's generally comes across as very aggressive. And he shut them up, he stopped, and he gave a really comprehensive answer. So my view of Dawkins has changed since
and
then.
Do you have a question for our panel?
I will now accept Richard as my own personal saviour. Thank you.
I thought that was my role.
Right. Madam, your question.
I'm interested in why people belong to churches. And I think I've got two points to make that you might like to answer. And
one question, please. We have a number of people at the microphones.
Okay. Well, then I'll skip the fact that they belong because we all like to belong to clubs and societies and it makes us feel good.
Please.
And I'll go to my real question, which is, do you think that a lot of it is down to Pascal's wager? And I'm not going to explain Pascal's wager because you asked for brevity.
You can't place it at the TAB, though, can
that's
you?
Yes, no. Perhaps, Paul, would you be happy to answer that, since it's a...
Well, it was years before I even found out what Pascal's wager was. I was born a Catholic. My parents were Catholics. My grandparents were Catholics. I grew up in a Catholic parish. I'm a completely enculturated Irish-Australian Catholic, but of Australian four generations back. Yes, it's very, very cultural. It's the way I view the world. I view the world through that lens. It's also profoundly experiential for me. I've experienced a beautiful worship. I've experienced beautiful music. I have, by being a Catholic, I'm in touch with some fairly significant people in the artistic landscape of our culture. You'll notice I haven't mentioned Jesus or God yet, because in a way they're just part of a whole box and dice. It's not just, you know, I didn't fall down on my knees, struck down on my namesake on the way to Damascus. I wasn't. It's just part of who I am, and to deny it would be to deny myself. No matter what the Catholic Church's problems are, and God knows I've highlighted them in public in Australia probably more than anybody else. I know all our problems, but that doesn't change the fact that it's part of my being.
Thank you. Could we move to the microphone at the back, please?
Hello, I'm Tori Wade. I think one of the big problems of the last 10 years has been the rise of fundamentalism in all religious traditions. And so my question is, what are the moderates or the mainstream in every religious tradition doing to publicly do something about the hatred and the bigotry that those sects or divisions are espousing to pull us apart?
Is there anyone who would like to take that question on for Islam?
I'll just start. I mean, I think one of the things I'd like to start, I don't think there's a general fundamentalism. I think fundamentalism is quite specific in different kinds of traditions, and I'm not really very happy about talking about fundamentalism as some sort of generic term. I think the differences between them are too different. I think in terms of why there's hatred and bigotry, etc., well, I think The reason why there's hatred and bigotry, I think it's more to do with conflict, and I think religion in that sense is simply a language through which conflict actually gets expressed rather than actually being a cause of conflict itself. And I think for me, for example, a lot of people talk about Israel-Palestine as a conflict about religion. Well, actually, rabbis and imams can actually agree on many things, they can disagree on things. It's not a theological issue. It becomes an issue about land, it's an issue about occupation, it's an issue about those kinds of things. So it seems to me that we have to be very, very careful that reading through the lens of the Christian experience and the rise of fundamentalism, which is a Christian phenomenon, because in a sense, in the idea of reading texts literally, well, I would defy anyone to read the Quran literally. The Quran is not like the Bible. It can't be read in the same way, whereas the Bible has different kinds of structure. So these different texts have different structures, different ways of being. For example, someone said about the church, well, as a Muslim, you don't really have a church. It's not a church organization. The mosques are not Muslim churches. So I think these differences are important to bear in mind before we have this kind of generalized kind of so notion of there is some sort of fundamentalism, etc. The question is really about dogmatism, why people are dogmatic. And if you're in a fight with somebody, then you probably tend to be dogmatic, since it makes it easier to fight with someone when you're dogmatic and not dogmatic. So I think we have to separate religion's role in this and the role of conflict itself.
Okay. Would any of the others like to add to that response?
Well, the Middle East does become a theological battleground, if only because of the fundamentalist Christians who are so important a part of the so-called Republican base, who see the last book of the Bible as a textbook on what's going to happen in the world, and who anxiously await the rapture, and for the rapture certain things have got to happen in Israel. So American foreign policy towards Israel
but
is
American
to
foreign
a remarkable extent based on that.
Well, the thing is that the right of the Christian crusaders, in a sense, and their entry into American military, etc., is a recent phenomenon. You can put it down to 20 years. But America's support for Israel has gone beyond that and lasts much longer than that. And the conflict between Palestine and Israel is much older than that. So it's not 100 years old, but it's much older than that. So I think certainly what's happened, and this is what I'm trying to say, there are increasing groups of American evangelicals who do see what's happening in the Middle East as a way of literalizing what they believe the apocalypse should be, etc. But that is not, that's very, very different than, for example, many other groups. I think quite often when people talk about fundamentalists, they actually mean Muslims. And they actually mean Muslims who they don't like. And so there are Muslims you like and Muslims you don't like. And regardless of what they believe or not, the ones you don't like end up being fundamentalists. So take something like Saudi Arabia. Because Saudi Arabia is an ally of the United States, quite often people don't talk about it as being fundamentalist, except when they're criticizing some aspect of it. Whereas Iran, which, for example, has women in parliament, which has women drivers, etc., is always considered to be fundamentalist. So the question would be to find fundamentalist as should be more than just simply a criterion of American foreign policy, that the ones that America likes are not fundamentalists regardless. That's why I think it's not a very useful term, really. Doesn't tell us anything. At the end of the day, people believe in the fundamentals of their religion, if that's what you mean by fundamentalist. But if you mean people who take things literally, well, literality is very, very different in different religious traditions.
Yes, well, I think that the key, you put your finger on the key issue there, Salman. The key issue is dogmatism. You have people who take things far too literally. Essentially, the Bible is poetry. I mean, a lot of it's history, but a lot of it's poetry, just as a lot of the Quran is poetry. And we don't interpret poetry literally. Doctrines, dogmas, teachings of churches, the word is derived from a Greek word which means mystery, but mystery not in the sense of Agatha Christie, that you get the clues and can work to the solution, or Sherlock Holmes. It means mystery in the sense of something so profound that it needs to be endlessly explored, and endlessly explored often metaphorically. Dogma, doctrine, is metaphor. It is not, we do not exhaust the reality by using human words, because by definition, the reality transcends human words. The problem with the dogmatist fundamentalist is they literalise everything. They've lost the poetry, and what boring people they are.
Can we just move to... Sorry, we'll just move to one more question. We have time for one more question, which we'll take from the front microphone. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I've long supported both Philip Adams and Richard Dawkins, so I don't want to see confusion between them. I also, like Philip, support diversity in Australian community and welcome and respect everyone's views. However, what gets my goat is when some particular religion, any religion, tries to impose its values on those who do not hold that religion. And I'm referring to things like abortion, euthanasia, recognition of gays, gay marriage. A whole lot of such issues arise where religion, it seems to me all the religions in Australia, try to impose their views on those of us who don't hold those views.
So your question then is,
I would
about
like
the appropriate
response of the people on the panel to this. Do they think that religious views on topics like abortion and euthanasia should be imposed on the whole of Australian community?
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yes, please.
Do you think any views should be imposed? It seems to me when you have the idea that religion imposes its views, you imply that other views are not imposed. I would put it to you, all views are imposed, and the ones which are imposed really well, we've forgotten they were imposed, and we take them to be our own. So it's... And I think this is kind of important to remember. Take something like gay rights. You know, the idea about gay rights, the people who are... for different sexual orientation should be legitimate equal citizens of a country is something very, very recent. Western culture wasn't wasn't based on gay rights 20, 30 years ago. So at that point, people were being imposed no gay rights. The people who were gay were being persecuted. So it seems to me that part of democratic or any society, you're always dealing with certain kinds of impositions. Now, you only think they're impositions when you disagree with them. Otherwise, you take them for granted. And that, it seems to me, is the stuff of life. And there's no point in saying religious people or people like this shouldn't impose their view, because the consequences of that is actually to end diversity. If you really believe in diversity, then you have to say, well, you know what? There are people who don't believe there should be abortion. I disagree with them, but at the same, and I will argue with that. But if there's no way of legislating them not to have those views, it seems to me that we can't actually legislate, and you can't simply say religious views or religious derived views have no place in society. They have as much place as any other views. So I think we should get away the idea that some views are being imposed and others are not. I think that's a big mistake.
Are there any others? Before I ask our panellists to give a one-minute summary or a one-minute final statement, do any of you here wish to add to anything that Salman just said in response to our last question?
I must say I agree with him.
Yeah.
And it depends from where you're coming. One person's imposition is another person's non-imposition. Sure. And as society develops and moves on, these debates and discussions will continue. But to necessarily blame it on religion or blame it on a particular religion, I don't think it's profitable. I don't think it leads us anywhere.
And one of the problems is that, of course, that some of us, perhaps not the Jewish community or the Muslim community, but some of us have very loud-mouthed spokespersons who wear archiepiscopal outfits. and that's part of the problem, that quite often they do not speak for the mainstream of the community. So I think that really needs, you know, the notion that Christians are all monolithic, it just isn't true.
Yes, thank you. Philip, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, Sam, I was going to make that point. No religious group is monolithic. The great fights are within them, between them. Islam isn't monolithic. Judaism certainly isn't monolithic. And nor is atheism.
Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen, I'd invite you each to say something to round out our conversation this afternoon, and perhaps we start, we'll just work our way along.
I guess I'd just like to make two very quick points. I think it might be helpful if we think about religion not as a sort of institution or a belief, set of beliefs, but maybe as a language through which we have expressed certain things at certain times and which plays a part in our public life. And I think if you think of it like a language, it gets us away from seeing it as a problem in itself, but simply as a way in which humans talk about certain kinds of things, partly talking to their ancestors, partly talking to those who come after us. So that seems to me as a useful way of thinking of religion rather than something especially, a special kind of activity that we do on Saturdays, Sundays or Fridays, depending on our, among the Abrahamic faiths.
Yes, yes.
So I think that's the first thing. And the final thing, and the other point I want to make is this. Everyone sort of talks about the value of democracy. I think sometimes we need to think of democracy not just as a slogan, but as a practice, which means that in terms of the relationship between diversity and democracy isn't just accidental, it is actually incident. It's intrinsic to it. And you can only accept diversity and be tolerant when you're actually confronted with views you disagree with. Views often when people who agree with, it's very easy to be tolerant of those who you agree with. There isn't much involved in that. And I think if you are going to think that this is a democratic society and democracy is a good thing, then it has to be more than just a slogan on a T-shirt. You have to live democratically, which means that you allow for the jostling and the argumentation of differences. And that, I think, is really crucial. That's the only lesson one needs to learn.
Thank you. Philip.
Well, simply make the point that there's a clear argument that no society is as strong as a multicultural society. As I go back to my bucket full of gravel, you can shake it, but you can't break it. And I celebrate diversity. I also have a habit of answering every letter that I ever receive. I even answer anonymous letters. That's true, because quite often, you get a vile letter from someone, anonymous, but from force of habit, they write their name and address on the envelope. And I have written countless thousands of letters, most of which are piled up in mouldering boxes at the National Library now, over decades, about religion. And I have a habit of answering the letters or finishing every letter with one sentence. Let us not let a little thing like God come between us.
Paul.
I could have been offended when you touched me when you mentioned vile letters. You're lucky you're a mate of mine, really, or else I might have called down the Inquisition on you.
You know you're my favourite Catholic.
We won't go into that. I just want to pick up something that Philip said in his early opening statement, and that's that we picked up the word spiritual, and I agree with you, it's a pathetic word, and it's an unfortunate word, I think, but I'm not sure that your word numinous, which of course you borrowed from Professor Ott, is any better. The word I prefer to use is transcendence. But the problem once you say that, you hook into those dreadful American transcendentalists, you see. So every word that we use to describe that which is beyond ourselves is difficult because we just can't get a word for it. But I do think that there is within Australian society, and I'm actually optimistic about our society, I do think that there is a search for that which is beyond the self. And I think that is stimulated by the narcissism that does, certainly without any doubt, operate within our society as well. And I think that people of goodwill do react against that and do look for that which transcends the self. And that, in a way, would be, I mean, I know that, I should be giving some theological definition of God, but that's what I see God as. And to tell the truth, I find that much more profoundly within the Australian landscape than I do within St. Peter's Basilica in Rome.
Thank you. John.
Well, it's very hard to come forth in a group such as this and say anything meaningful, but I must say I agree with Philip that I think that diversity is absolutely fundamental to the development of our society, and I think that we, in that diversity, we have to understand one another. We have to have a discourse. We're going to have disagreements, but we have to talk about those disagreements, have a discourse, understand one another before we attack one another. And I think that society, and I'm very optimistic about our society in Australia. I think we've got a diverse, multicultural society. We live with each other in peace, and I have great confidence that while we continue to talk to one another, understand one another, our society will develop in a way in which many societies have not developed. And I think sessions such as this are an example of how we can have a discourse and understand one another.
Thank you. And thank you. And thank you to you, the members of the audience, if I may borrow a phrase from Philip's program, The Gladdies and the Potties. Thank you for your presence here on a beautiful Sunday afternoon. Our team has asked that you clear the auditorium as soon as possible so that they can set up for the next session. And as we conclude, I would ask you to thank our four panellists.
Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.